there's Will, but I want to go ahead and start. You know, I've got about a half an hour with Laura Downs. And I just, you know, want to say, well, I'm Stephen Beschloss with America America. And, you know, I've had a chance to talk to Laura before, but really happy to do this on Sunday as we get so close to her event on this week at Lincoln Center. If you don't know, Laura's a renowned pianist. She's a recording artist. She's a musical curator. And she specifically created a project called the Declaration Project, which she's worked on over the last several years, and we'll surely want to dig into that. It's key to the 250th anniversary of America, a multimedia musical event, which is premiering on July 1st. Great to see you, Laura.
Nice to see you, too.
Pleasure, pleasure. So let's just jump in. I know you've just gotten back from the Aspen Ideas Festival. How was that?
I think it's my new favorite place. It was really fascinating. It really was. I mean, obviously, as one knows, they're just, you know, so many different perspectives swirling around. But I think especially in the context of this project, it was the perfect place to be and to share and to gather other perspectives on what this moment means. Really lots of cross currents. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know that you had a chance actually to, I gathered, to do an interview or to spend time with Eddie Gloud. Can you tell me about that? I mean, readers of America America would know that I did, and who have seen Six Questions know that I did a conversation with Eddie. And, you know, he's just such a fantastic creative thinker.
Yeah, that was the last thing that I did before I went to the airport. And they had asked me to do a talk with Eddie because his book, as you know, each chapter is introduced with a phrase of music, which then at the end of the book, all of those phrases coalesce into this piece. And so the idea being that my survey of 250 years of American history is through the lens of music, and his is through something very different. But it was really phenomenal. What we did was we played a game that I invented called Nerd Trivia. And I had just all his book travels through these 50-year spans,
right,
to all of the anniversaries that have been celebrated. And so I had kind of put together my perspective on what was happening musically at those same touch points and handed him that little factoid, and then he kind of painted the history around it. And it was really
interesting,
you know, so 1976 and 1926 and backwards from there. And I don't know, I think because of what I had to say about the music, like, for example, my historical musical pinpoint for 1876 was in 1876, the Fisk University Jubilee Singers international tour, because Fisk was in dire straits and they needed to raise money. So it was the first time that they took those spirituals into a national and international stages. And you know, to me, that's this beautiful moment of reclaiming this history, of elevating or repositioning that music in a way that it then had a future life. And for he had a different perspective on that. But yeah, we ended up having a dialogue that it really depends through which lens you look at that. Are you looking at that through the eyes of the receivers of that music or the makers of the music? I was really interested.
Well, so let's just linger there for a minute. 1876, so that's the centennial for the country's founding. Why that music at that time?
I mean, well, because of the immediate collapse of what was built up during Reconstruction, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, from his point of view, this is a tragic statement about America's failure
Sure.
to sustain that, right? And from mine as well. But for me, the action of these Black musicians taking that lineage into their own hands and insisting upon it,
yeah,
and using it as their argument for this institution and for a different perspective and respect and acknowledgement of Black achievement and Black excellence, to me, I see that as self-affirmation. And yeah.
Well, it seems like in some ways that's a good segue into talking about the Declaration Project, because mm-hmm. it, 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 you know, it's a musical project, maybe first and foremost for you. It's a chance, been a chance for you to delve into the, you know, into the history of, let's say, American music, obviously to do new, connect with new work as well. But maybe you can talk a little bit about the origins of it, you know, both in terms of what you were after musically, but also, you know, what you thought that would open up in terms of being able to gather sort of insights about America.
Yeah. And I mean, I have to say first and foremost that this is a project that's taken 2 years. So if we think of everything that's happened in the last 2 years, it really is a product of its time, just because this time itself has been so wildly fluctuating in terms of how we're experiencing America. So 2 years ago, in the summer of 2024, Lincoln Center came to me and offered, you know, to bring me in to design something to celebrate this 250th. And the original idea was to commission new work to mark this moment. So they've commissioned three new works called Life, Liberty, and The Pursuit of Happiness. And those are for piano and orchestra. And the rest was sort of a blank slate. And I started thinking about a storyline around that, a framework for that. And as I told you, my first impulse was to, you know, just dig into text and go back 250 years and what are the essential moments and the essential voices and how can we create some sort of tapestry of American history? And that became very quickly very overwhelming. But also as time went on, as the events of the last 2 years have started unfolding, I realized that the danger here is to fetishize history. I think that we are trapped in it. And the opportunity here is to look at that history as a platform on which to build. So I felt that it was really important to capture the voices of the nation today and see where they're pointing. So I've turned my usual, you know, touring musician road life into this kind of reciprocal listening exercise and offering my perspective, my American vision and my American understanding, which is through music, and then asking for, in response, the personal reflection and vision on being American today, on the American past, and specifically on the American future. And it's yielded hundreds and hundreds of responses. Your readers participated in this exercise.
Right.
And all of that is now becoming this beautiful multimedia component of the show at Lincoln Center on Wednesday night.
And where you're sharing, you know, beyond the music, you're also sharing voices from quite a few people.
I mean, it's really, it's like a postcard from America.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that's so interesting, and I want to sort of get at what, you know, as you travel the country, what people were and are sort of thinking and feeling. I think it's so important in this moment, but it strikes me if you rewind 2 years ago, well, we were on the precipice of a possible President Kamala Harris. So I'm guessing when you started, you had a different notion of what the project might look like if in fact she were elected.
I was really remembering this week, it's viscerally present, just exactly 2 years ago, I had another concert here in New York. It was under the Brooklyn Bridge in Brooklyn Bridge Park. We did this centennial celebration of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. And we were working with Headcount, which is a nonprofit that registers voters. And there was so much energy because we were going to register all these voters and get our first, you know, round of president. And everybody felt so optimistic. And I remember in those first conversations with Lincoln Center, you know, we were all just so certain that this moment when we got here was going to be, you know, we'd be in the midst of this new era in this country.
Yeah.
And remember, too, that along the way, I mean, regardless of just like our personal psyche, but these real things have happened in my space, you know, the NEA cuts and the crackdown and the censorship and all of this. It's been so personally, I don't like to use the word, overuse the word, but traumatic. There's been a lot of trauma.
Yeah, but of course, and I don't doubt that for you and for so many people, obviously. But it also strikes me that makes a project like yours that much more important to be able to create the context for the voices to be heard, for voices to be lifted. So maybe
so much resolve. Yeah, it's like fine, take away the money. I'm going to do this anyway.
Yeah. So you had a mission when you started. Has it changed over these couple of years?
Completely changed. Completely changed because You know, I think that the greatest threat, the worst action has been the silencing. Mm. Everybody has felt silenced. So to create these opportunities for voicing of ideas and fears and hopes, that has felt really, really powerful.
Yeah, powerful and necessary. Again, necessary to gather it, but also necessary to create, you know, the opportunity sort of for people to feel, you know, not just engaged, to feel like they're not alone, and you know, and people do care what they have to say. So it strikes me, if you would, that it's, again, I want to hear a little bit, it's maybe hard to summarize, but what were, if you were to describe sort of thoughts and feelings as you travel the country, and I'm thinking of younger people and older people, but can you characterize it in some way, what you think was emerging, maybe some of what surprised you?
Well, I'll tell you this. At Aspen, the opening session, as part of the opening session, and David Brooks and Fareed Zakaria had a conversation just before I spoke.
Yeah.
They were talking about Trump and the age of pessimism and whether that is or is not coming to an end. And so I was listening to them talking about all these statistics about Americans. And since I forget what year, but, you know, our optimism and energy has apparently gone way down and people are polled and they have no hope. And also how Trump ran on that that platform, that pessimism. Okay, so this was, you know, a big discussion.
Country is dead now. It's been dead under Biden, and
yes, exactly,
you know,
that.
It's a destroyed landscape, and you know, only he can come and save it.
Yes, exactly. What was it? American carnage, that whole thing, and gross. But also, I was sitting there listening and thinking, why did I not have this experience? Why, in these hundreds of conversations that I've had, am I not picking up on that? I'm not picking up on pessimism. I'm picking up on despair. And sadness and fear, but there has been consistently an undercurrent of, whether you want to call it optimism or resistance or, you know, whatever it is, there's not a like, here we are and we're going to stay here. That's not it. Younger people certainly, and one of the things I said when I got up on the stage, and I didn't want to just like contradict them, they're right and they're wrong.
Yeah.
I said, I feel like we talk too much about the moment. We're always talking about this moment, this American moment. And in fact, yeah, it is a moment. So if you're going to take a poll, maybe you're going to get a certain response. But if you are talking to people about the long view of their lives, of this country, then this is a moment. And if you talk to somebody who is 11 years old, this moment doesn't matter very much. Because they're looking always at the future. What am I going to do when I'm, you know, when I'm grown up, when I can do what I want to do? And also, when I've been speaking with older people, they see this moment as part of a cycle of moments, you know, and depending on who you're talking to, when you're in Tuskegee, Alabama, working in a Black community, no one is going to tell you that this is the worst thing that's ever happened.
Right, right. Right. I think that's so important. Again, you know, we all come to this moment with our own particular, you know, life experiences and perceptions and narratives about, you know, about what it means to live in America. I mean, I try to say, I do this relatively often when people are in this place of, you know, darkness and despair, to say, like, you know, think about what it was like in the, you know, in the late 1860s for Black Americans, right? Think about, you know, throughout the period where the, you know, the terrorizing of the Ku Klux Klan, or, you know, we can pick so many periods in American history where surely Americans have struggled and suffered, dealt with quite painful conditions, worse than our moment. So I think it's important to put that in context.
You know, at the close of my talk with Eddie, someone had a question about how he's able to do his work now without just succumbing to rage and despair. And he said, you know, A, I'm not okay. Don't think I'm okay. But also, to quote I think it was his grandmother, you know, we got to get our babies to the other side. We have to be doing this work so that it can be better. And that's really consistently what I've heard traveling. Whatever is going to be done, it has to be done so that things can be better.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I will say that when I shared sort of your your prompt about the, you know, the pursuit of happiness, you know, with my readers. I mean, well, a lot of them are very pessimistic as a result of the, you know, the tragedies, the violations of Trump. But what's those dark feelings, you know, in some ways overwhelm a lot of people. When I asked specifically yesterday about the 4th of July, are people feeling at all like celebrating? Well, there was not a lot of feeling for celebration. Which again makes your project important as a response. But I want to dig into that. But I want to just ask you first about you know, some of those young people that you spoke to. Can you give a few examples of how they viewed sort of not just this moment, but what it means to be American?
It's really so dependent, I think, on background and family experience. I mean, you would be surprised at how many responses that we would consider sort of textbook patriotic came from young people who are first generation Americans, first generation college goers, this awareness, you know, of what sacrifices were made and for why. Like, my parents or my grandparents chose to make this sacrifice. There's got to be a reason. And the reason is up to me to fulfill. That hasn't changed. That just simply hasn't changed. So there's, you know, lots of the kids I spoke to so outraged about ICE, about, you know, all of these policies that are real and present for them, sure. But also just, you know, aware again of their opportunity as young people to make a difference in this country. And I think that that's uniquely ours, this feeling that whether it's as hard as it may appear, we do have the opportunity to make.
So let's talk about the music. I know you've spent, you know, many years actually exploring, you know, in a way, the history of American music, maybe particularly the history of Black American music. I'm wondering about, you know, what would be a few examples that you might point to. Maybe it's particular pieces that you love or that you think are, or, you know, that convey important stories to tell us now.
No. Well, okay, I'll say this. When it came to this concert coming up next week, I chose to curate three American songs that I consider to be iconic. And not necessarily chronologically spanning our history, but three songs that just say something powerful about what has been, what can be. Mm-hmm. And I landed on Paul Simon's American Tune, Billy Taylor / Nina Simone's I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, and combined, cheated, therefore, Over the Rainbow and Leonard Bernstein's Somewhere. Mm. These are all very hopeful songs.
They are.
They all came into being in very dark times in this country. So to me, they demonstrate, you know, this like insistence of American music on the possibility of better, of tomorrow, of, you know, we shall overcome.
Yeah.
And also, I think they have a lot to say, each of them, about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I've created this really diverse cohort of artists who come from many places in the American landscape so that when we sing these songs, we're also honoring many different traditions. And I think it's powerful. Yesterday, my life's been a little. Yesterday, I was at Lincoln Center all day because I had curated a festival called Next 250, which is a young artist showcase of young people from all over the country, young musicians. Mm-hmm. And there was an ensemble, a jazz ensemble from Juilliard, and they did I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. And then I just jumped up on the stage and had a conversation with the kids who were playing about that song.
Yeah.
How much it means. And it was funny because I spoke about it with Eddie also in our talk the other day, 1976. It was the bicentennial. And, you know, we were coming out of all kinds of terrible in this country. And that just happened to be the year that Nina gave this electric performance in Montreux of I Wish I Knew How It Felt to Be Free. And you watch that video. Yes. Yeah. And it's like all the rage, all of the electricity, all of the change that's, you know, just bubbling and the revolution. At the same time that we were in 1976, from what I understand, it was a very, like, fireworks and very Disneyland version of a celebration.
But these songs are optimistic. I want in general. I mean, I wonder whether that's a indicative of who you are.
I mean, what choice do I have? Look, my family, you know, my great-grandparents. So on one side, I'm Jewish, and on the other side, I'm Black. You know, we don't tend to just sit That's around and say, oh, things terrible. You know, you pack a suitcase and you go, or you... I come from
the history of persecution and survival.
Yes, and resilience and resilience, and also I think that as an artist, I think that it's part of my job. I didn't expect to live through this time. I did not expect American music to take on the significance for myself and for my listeners that it has now. But here we are, and I you know, I've learned that I can do good with it. I can help somehow. So I don't know. I mean, I sometimes struggle with this word optimism, because I think it can just get put in a place where it sounds like you sit around and think pretty sauce. It's not that.
Sure. Well, no, I mean, look, in the darkest times, optimism sort of represents the ability to hopefully to engage it, but also in the reality of it, but also to be able to see through it in some way, right? See beyond it, see forward. And you know, I mean, look, the darkest, most despairing, most pessimistic can't see beyond, all right? They get trapped in the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, the optimism is what makes you get on that boat and cross that ocean. Otherwise, you're just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you're making me thinking about Irving Berlin, you know, whose music, you know, he came to America, Russian immigrant, struggled to kind of make something to survive in lower Manhattan, you know, in the tenement world, all of that, and starts writing these incredibly patriotic songs, you know, God Bless America, and songs that are, you know, in some ways define the time, that are sort of triumphant, and maybe it was a way to overcome the struggles that he knew were all around him.
Absolutely. Eddie and I returned to, I know I shared with you my story about Rhapsody in Blue in 1924, and what a god-awful year that was. And, you know, the Klan is like rampaging all over the country, and it's the Johnson Reed Act, and really it's dark. And Gershwin writes this piece, which he describes as his vision of the musical kaleidoscope of America. He's celebrating the melting pot. And for me, that is an act of optimism, but also protest, you know, also resistance. Like, here I am. And whether you are telling me that my people don't belong here or not, I am America. And I'm going to write the most American piece of music you've ever heard. And it's going to be, you know, iconic from now on. That's radical.
Yeah. Yeah. So is there, I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, the concert that you're creating, you know, this week, and I know it's not the only moment, but it's one moment. I mean, what is it that you're hoping people sort of emerge with? What is it that they're, you know, they're come, I presume most of the people are coming to listen to music, but the music is obviously at the center of it. What is it that you want them to, and I know you can't, we're not going to tell people what to take from it, but what do you hope it creates for people?
Yes, the music is at the heart of it. And also, I don't know, the voices are at the heart of it. I mean, really, I think that what I've done in the end is I've brought America into David Geffen Hall. You know, all of these videos, I don't know if we said, but all of these videos that I've been collecting all over the country, there's this gorgeous multimedia installation that's an integral part of the concert. So throughout the concert, you're going to be seeing these voices and faces of Americans. I brought back the choir from Tuskegee with me. They're coming.
Wow. This is historic. And they'll be there this week.
Yeah, they'll be singing in the concert.
What are they performing?
Washington. They're singing in all of those songs that I just mentioned.
So all right.
Be a distant presence. And to me, I mean, that's just kind of one of the achievements of my life to date, to bring this choir back to New York. They were here in the 19th. They sang at the opening of Radio City Music Hall in 1932. They're coming back. And these young people, they really moved me. I spent a long, long, long day with them doing the Declaration Project. So they'll be here. These
How
artists,
many years?
They're like 20, 25 kids coming. We're going into the WNYC the morning before to tape a special just about the history of the choir. It's an amazing history, you know, out of Tuskegee. There's a 17-year-old bluegrass mandolin player who's here from Knoxville, Tennessee. And I just think that it's an opportunity to come and witness for yourself what America is, because I think we are all tired of our algorithms and our media telling us what America is. These 2 years have really just been such a relief, a reality check for me.
Well, I have to say, I mean, you know, with some colleagues, when I've talked to them about sort of the challenges of this year and sort of digging right into a lot of the, you know, the day-to-day onslaught politically, it's been hard. And I've had actually several people who made a point of saying to me, you know, what I've been doing is listening to a lot of music documentaries, and how that's been nourishing. And it strikes me again that, you know, what you're doing is so important to remind people, you know, that there's another way of engaging this moment that might be, a source of uplift rather than depressing or discouraging. And it seems to me that there's an opportunity also to get sort of new insights. Right. New ways of thinking. So let me just ask you, I've got a couple of last things I want to get at. But, you know, one is what music would you urge people to listen to this year, you know, perhaps to get new insights about both our history and our future?
You know, for me, I think where I'm finding comfort and strength in my relationship with American music is just to look back and to acknowledge, as we said earlier, that American musicians and like the sound of American music has always been pointing towards the future and something better from the very beginning. Because if we go all the way back, you know, the roots of American music lie in the music of enslavement. Mm-hmm. These spirituals then morphed into, the blues and jazz and just American music in general. So I go back there a lot and look at whether it's the 1960s or the 1930s, you know, all the times when American music has spoken for us, it has kind of spoken of us and for us and been a source of gathering and of encouragement and support. And also, it's really important to remember, it's hard for us to think about this, but music wasn't always a commercial thing. Music mm-hmm. existed so that people could come together and breathe together and feel together and share that kind of uplift. And, you know, so right when you were singing a song out in the fields or in your church or in your home, it was really for that purpose of feeling community and love and affirmation and the strength to keep going. So I don't know that I would, there is a Declaration Project playlist, which we can share together. But also I think, you know, just whatever to you speaks of, maybe think about when were times bad before. I find myself all the time it's another Paul Simon tune, but I've been starting my concerts with America. You know, 1964 was not a great time either.
And
he writes this song about looking for America, and I think that's what I'm doing in my music.
Looking for America, that's right. So I mean, one last sort of look back, if we might. I know that you've, over the last few years, you've discovered a lot of music. Is there a piece in particular that sort of stands out that you're, I don't know, maybe proudest that you found? I mean, that you didn't know about before, and know about it now, and that means a lot to you?
I'm going to tell you the best story, and this is an Aspen story too. So on the first night I was there, I had curated the opening concert, and it was hilariously a survey of 250 years of American music in under an hour. So I had brought in all kinds of friends who represent different touch points in that tradition. And we were doing a really nice job of connecting at the crossroads, you know. So here's Layla McCalla with her banjo showing us a song from, you know, that sort of has Haitian origins from New Orleans and then 19th century. And then we moved from there to Scott Joplin. And it was actually really illuminating. Okay, so we finished this concert and I'm talking with people and the hall is mostly cleared out. And here comes this really tiny little blonde person running up to me. And she said, "Hi, I'm Kate." And I said, "Oh, I know who you are." It was Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live. She was there also as a speaker. And the piece, she loved this concert, but she specifically loved this piece that I play a lot by Margaret Bonds, who is a Black American composer working in the 1930s, Chicago-based. And she wrote this virtuoso fantasy based on Wade in the Water. So Kate wanted to know all about, like, you know, where did this music come from? And so I told her about Margaret Bonds. And then the next morning, she came in and found me at breakfast, and she said, I want you to know I was up so late last night going down this rabbit hole learning all about this composer. And I was so joyful that I'd been able to share that with her and that it had activated something in her curiosity. Because I guess, I mean, the short answer to your question is I'm just grateful and proud that I've been able to excavate all this music that was in such danger of being completely erased.
Right.
All these Black composers, you know, who history chose to erase, and to do the painstaking, solitary, effortful work that I have done for about 20 years to, you know, reclaim it from libraries and perform it and insist on recording it, even when nobody wanted to help. And now to see it coming out into the world at a time when all of this erasure is so threatening, so dangerous.
Yeah.
Because music, once you've recorded, that's a good thing. Once you've recorded a piece of music, it remains. It's there. And every time I'm able to bring somebody into that fold, whether they're, you know, the funniest person on earth or you know, anyone at all. And especially, you know, when I'm working in communities of color and letting very young people know, here's your heritage. Here's your lineage. It's, you know, exists in the sound. That brings me joy every time.
Well, I'm grateful that you've helped to make sure these songs aren't lost, these composers aren't forgotten, and I'm sure many of the people who are listening today actually feel the same way. And I suspect you've already inspired a lot of people to think about going back and listening to music that they know and love, or maybe music that they mm-hmm. haven't heard before, but realize might actually either provide uplift or provide insights that are helpful in this time. And I just want to underscore, I think, how important it is that you said sort of from the beginning about this moment. It's a moment, it's a tough moment. It's a tragic moment, I think, for America, to be sure. And none of us know how this is going to play out. But it's important to remember that it is a moment in the span of American history. Well, we go back 250 years. Maybe we should go back longer to really understand the American story of 400 years and more. But we're still in the middle of it. We're still in the midst of it. And that's, I think that's the truth. And I hope that your music and, you know, the work that you're doing helps people to recognize that.
Thank you. And thank you for what you do. You know, when we first met, I told you, I don't know how you do this every day. Yeah. You do have to be in the moment, you know, yeah. And you have to sort of interpret the moment. And it's important for all of us.
Well, that's why it's important that I'm able to talk to great people like you and to, you know, to find ways to you know, nourish myself and provide insights for myself that help to keep me motivated and sort of believing in the future. So I hope people make it on Wednesday night at Lincoln Center. What happens to the project after this week?
Well, I fly on Thursday morning to the UK. I'm playing the same music with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, staying in London doing some things with the BBC. And then I have another concert at Mass Mocha up in the Berkshires on the 18th. And then, you know, I'm really looking at this as the start of a new chapter. I'm launching a project called Sounds Like America of, you know, what is happening now? How are we defining this next chapter? So.
And so this work is an ending after once we hit to the 251st year, you're still going.
Yeah. And look, I've got 250 years to do this. So
good. Thank you. Thank you so much for talking and I hope people enjoyed it. If you haven't listened to Laura's music, you know, go out and listen. You have a new album coming out.
Oh, yeah. There's a new album
5 days.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Say the name of it. Make sure people check it out.
Yeah, it's called Hold These Truths, and it is really looking back on, you know, these 250 years, but really through the lens of like how has the music helped us along?
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic. So keep doing the good fight. It's uplifting for a lot of us. Thank you. Pleasure.
Well, one thing about Wednesday night, the concert. What I loved, which is very democratic about Lincoln Center, it's pay what you choose. Mm. So you can buy tickets for $5 or also a lot more if you want. But I really love that. And I hope that people will take advantage because that's important in the arts.
That's a really big wow.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
Well done. Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Look forward to talking with you again, Laura.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.